I like to characterize the last decade as the era of chemo radiation. I'm going to go through some data that I think you're all very familiar with, but I think it's important because it puts us into perspective of where we are today and how we got there. You know that back in 1991, the widely acclaimed and so-called VA study was published. Greg Wolf and his colleagues demonstrated that it was possible in patients with limited laryngeal cancer to save 60% of the organs with chemoradiation. That is, you didn't have to do surgery. The 60% in some respects is the fine print. We do know that patients do fail, and something in the vicinity of 40% of these patients need laryngectomy for salvage. In the ensuing years, there were some widely acclaimed and certainly widely quoted prospective randomized trials done by our colleagues in medical and radiation oncology that, for instance, demonstrated that concurrent chemoradiation was better than radiation alone and better than sequential chemo followed by radiation. So what do we know? Well, I think we know concurrent chemoradiation is better, although it continues to be challenged. And we know that chemoradiation therapy, which we'll discuss as CRT for the rest of the time, may offer preservation of the larynx to 60% of patients. But what's happened? There's a great tendency among doctors to generalize. I think perhaps it's because they don't always read the fine print. And some centers, I find, are offering CRT to most patients with head and neck cancer. That's wrong. Chemoradiation is too much therapy for early stage disease. And then, quite frankly, and I'll expand on this in just a second, T4 tumors were largely excluded in the big prospective randomized trials. I mean, you understand when an investigator puts together a trial, he tries not to hurt people. And so the people that put together the famous RTOG 9111, when the EORTC put together their trial, they avoided the really bad boys because they figured it wouldn't work. And by the way, it doesn't. So if you don't read that, if you don't pay attention, of course, you miss the opportunity. So the current standard of care for T3 laryngeal cancer, I believe, is CRT. I think it's reasonable, and I do concur that 60%, maybe even a few more, of the larynxes can be preserved. But going in, you need to understand that you will fail sometimes, and that is patients do need laryngectomies. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are some continuing challenges, unequivocal challenges, like how do you follow patients after CRT? We use PET-CT. I'll tell you about that in a minute. There's just no doubt we abuse that modality. How do we avoid some of these complications of CRT? Because we all see them. What is the best chemo, by the way? It hasn't changed very much. I mean, the people I work with continue to think that cisplatin is better than anything else. Can the biologics replace the platin? Well, maybe, but there's a good deal of cynicism among the community of medical oncologists. They're not sure that erbitoxis is good. And, oh, by the way, can CRT save something that's been destroyed, such as a T4 larynx? These are important questions, and anybody who's treating patients like this needs to understand that. And then this is some fun data from radiation oncology. When they went back and analyzed the results of almost 500 patients treated on RTOG trials, severe toxicities existed in 43%. So what that means is that in this exuberant chase to preserve function, we're failing. We fail because some patients are not cured, but we also fail because this treatment is, in fact, very toxic. And it's true that a great deal of effort is being made to find ways to avoid or prevent these toxicities. They remain an issue. So let's be as specific as we can. T1 and T2, early laryngeal cancer. Number one, we need to avoid overtreatment. There is absolutely no reason a patient with an early laryngeal cancer needs two modalities, okay? Either take it out or you radiate it. And maybe you can give it chemo. Those data are interesting, but not convincing in my mind. Cancer control is excellent. And oh, by the way, these patients do great. They have good voice, they swallow well, and they rarely have excessive toxicity from treatment. It doesn't happen. This is what I grew up with. This is old. This is like real dinosaur information. Radiation gives a better voice. It's not true. It's the same. Similar cure rates. It's pretty much true, but I'll show you some data in a minute. And the radiation is less morbidity. Well, let me talk about that too in a minute. And so let's go to this simple slide and ask how best to treat this patient. Well, the way this all started, you know, is astute observers noticed that patients like this were often cured with a biopsy. So these astute observers, the most articulate of whom has been Wolfgang Steiner, said, why don't we just take it all out through the scope and be done with it? And to put this in perspective, those of us who do head and neck oncology need to be familiar with these data. These are Bill Mendenhall's data. They're a decade old now, but they're still the best in the world. Now, I say that because it's probably better than the radiation performance of the guy you're working with, okay? But be that as it may, Mendenhall. So he reports that T1s, ultimate control, 98%. T2s, ultimate control, 96%. Congratulations. But, you know, over here in the last column is where the information that's important resides. Because you see that voice under T2, it means something between 18 and 24% of the larynxes were taken out. That's called laryngectomy to get to this excellent ultimate control rate. These are the best in the world. So if you have a T2 patient and you're going to send them for a radiation, he better understand that there is some significant chance he will end up with a laryngectomy. This operation, which is cartooned here, is called a hemilaryngectomy. This operation, in large part, is obsolete. There is no one in North America doing this operation for the picture I showed you a minute ago. We don't do this for T1 laryngeal cancer. This operation is effective, but it always has more morbidity and gives a poor voice. And given those choices, I, too, would send the patient for a radiation. But, you know, today, everywhere in the world, there is expertise that can take that little tumor out with an endoscope, and the morbidity is very limited. The operation takes less than an hour. There's no overnight hospitalization. And so I should call your attention to a couple of things that are perhaps not very good but important. This textbook called Evidence-Based Otolaryngology, published by Greg Randolph and his group a couple years ago, is depressing because it points out in vivid detail that we don't have much good evidence. But he points out that for T1 gliotic cancer, there's no randomized clinical trial. And limited level 3 evidence suggests that it's comparable survival. And there's no difference in voice or quality of life. That's true. And then we all heard Getty last year at COSM point out that actually the meta-analysis today, 2010, 2011, favors surgery for small laryngeal cancers. The disease-specific outcomes actually are a little better. The laryngectomy-free survival is clearly better. The treatment time is are shorter, and the cost is cheaper than a course of a radiation therapy. Those are the data for today. So if you're seeing patients with T1 and T2 laryngeal cancer, they should not be getting a radiation uniformly. They should be evaluated by somebody who's capable of doing the endoscopic procedure. There are cases that should be irradiated, that's for sure, but they should be evaluated by a surgeon capable of doing the endoscopic resection before they're sent for radiation. Anterior commissure lesions, in my mind, are a special problem. Some of our colleagues differ with me. They say, oh, it's no problem, but I think they're a problem. But I can tell you that partial surgical techniques to take out anterior commissure lesions are still associated with a very high success rate, very high, certainly more than 90%. And I've showed you the Mendenhall data. The T2s don't do so well. So some of these patients end up with laryngectomy. So in deciding therapy for T2 laryngeal cancer, it's a tough one, I think. You know, do you want to have a procedure that will probably leave you with anterior web and some changes in your voice and almost certain tumor control, or would you rather take a chance to go with your radiation thing? My procedure of choice for anterior commissure lesion is a frontal lateral hemilaryngectomy. The good news is it has associated with a very high degree of tumor control. The bad news is it's associated with a subpar voice. There are those who, I think, can routinely take these out endoscopically, not me. So that's where I am in my thinking. Frontal lateral hemilaryngectomy frequently requires some form of reconstruction. I just call this to your attention. You have to reestablish the lumen of the airway or you'll have stenosis. And endoscopic resection, of course, is badgered by the scarring in the interior commissure and, of course, the web. So to move on, let's talk about supraglottic cancer. I think that actually small supraglottic cancers are ideally suited for treatment with surgery alone, but they got to be limited disease. Elective neck dissection is essential until, perhaps you heard it earlier this morning, we can actually use some kind of sentinel node mapping and rapid PCR to determine who doesn't need an elective neck dissection. And we continue to struggle with what are the indications for adjuvant irradiation and chemo, such as multiple nodes, extracapsular spread. It'd be nice to know all of this before surgery. There are a multitude of techniques for supraglottic cancer. I grew up with supraglottic laryngectomy. Supracricoid laryngectomy is out there, but I'm afraid many of us have not learned to really do this correctly. And then, of course, there's the endoscopic techniques. All of these result in temporary dysphagia. So what the operative problem here, of course, is that patients with compromised pulmonary function are not candidates for endoscopic resection any more than they would be for a supraglottic. And then here's a Steiner cartoon demonstrating what we all know, and that is to chip off a tumor from the tip of the epiglottis is pretty easy. Those are the easy ones. The hard ones, of course, are the bigger supraglottic tumors. And these are Pittsburgh data from a few years ago, which argues that unilateral neck dissection is inferior to bilateral neck dissection for patients with supraglottic cancer, irrespective of the site. So the recurrence rate in the neck is far lower if you do a bilateral neck dissection, and actually disease-specific survival is lower, although the P is not nearly so impressive. Today, patients treated for supraglottic cancer should have both necks treated, and we do levels 2A, 3, and 4. I'm led to believe that my colleagues in Europe do 2A and 3. 4 is a chip shot, and maybe we just don't communicate effectively. And then here's some data that we've not published yet. But what this looks at is a series of over 1,500 patients with elective neck dissection. And then we look at the nodes, how many positive nodes, and then the relative hazard of recurrence. And you see that it starts pretty soon. Like even patients with no nodes recur sometimes. And by the time you get up to 4 or 5 nodes, obviously these patients are at great risk. So the question remains, how many nodes represents indication for adjuvant therapy? In Pittsburgh, I can tell you we use 3 or more. I know others use other numbers. Well, here's the problem, and that is, how much risk are you willing to accept before you add irradiation and chemotherapy? And of course, when you add therapy, you add toxicity. And this is the same thing, the relative hazard of local regional recurrence and survival in terms of number of nodes. Again, it goes right up, but there's always some risk even with 0 nodes. I guess that's the problem we have with cancer today, is we don't know how to reliably treat and cure everybody. So let's move on to advanced laryngeal cancer. I mean, CRT has been promoted as a way to preserve function, you know, organ preservation. Well, when we do the reading, we find that in RTOG 9111, only 11% had T4 tumors, and in the EORTC study, only 4%. So I said that earlier. The big tumors were avoided, and of course, the big tumors have cartilage invasion. The patients with these tumors are aspirating, they have dysphagia, and there's often extra laryngeal cancer. And these data are telling because this shows that survival after surgery and irradiation is better, ladies and gentlemen, is better than CRT even after you salvage the failures with laryngectomy. In other words, you can't salvage with laryngectomy effectively. You can't move the green line to the yellow line. So patients with T4 tumors are at increased risk to die if they get CRT. It's as simple as that. And then there's been, you know, I told you that 60% or so of the patients with more limited primaries have organ preservation with CRT. So how many patients or what percentage can you save who have T4 tumors? And the answer is, I don't know. These are Michigan data. They're just published. They started off with 36 patients with T4 larynx cancer. They gave them all CRT. And in the end of the day, they saved 36% of the larynxes. So I'm going to guess that's probably right. If you can save 60% of T2, T3s, maybe you save 40% of T4s. I'm sure you save some, but understand that if you treat T4 tumors with CRT, you're not going to save 60%. And, of course, the same difficulties, anatomic deformity, chronic edema, how do you tell recurrence from scar? So we've used PET CT. I told you we've used it, I'm sure, too much. There's false positives. False positives, especially troublesome if you do your PET CT too soon after finishing treatment. And, you know, frankly, I recommend biopsying or confirming the PET CT before you do something too destructive. These data are similarly unpublished, but what this looks at is recurrence-free survival in months after the completion of CRT. And what you see is that right around 3 years, you've observed almost all of the recurrences. What that means to me is that there's little indication to get a PET CT after 24 or 30 months unless there's a change in the physical findings or the patient's symptoms. So before I leave, I wanted to spend 2 seconds addressing the characteristics of recurrent tumor because people ask me, well, Jonas, can we resect a tumor that was inoperable once? And the answer is sometimes. These data from Peter Zabarin, I think, are the most provocative and probably representative of the truth, because Peter points out that when you deal with primary tumors, which is what we like to do, take out a tumor, about 80% are concentric. In other words, they have margins. You take the whole thing out. Your pathologist says your margins are okay, and you win. But when you look at patients who are having surgery after a radiation, 86% have multifocal tumor. So here's the Johnson cartoon that if you've seen before, forgive me. But if you start with a big tumor and you give the patient poison, like a radiation and chemotherapy, sometimes this happens. It's concentric shrinkage. This would be Dr. Zabarin's 14%. And the other 86% have multifocal recurrent tumor. So obviously, if you, the surgeon, are going to take it out, you've got to take out all the pieces or you lose. That's why salvage surgery is relatively ineffective. That's why the answer to can you salvage radiation failure is sometimes. So that, a partial response, of course, is a complete failure. Lastly, let me show you some information from the National Inpatient Sample that's terribly important to us. This compares two time periods, the time period 93 to 2000, and then the time period from 2001 to 2008. These data are based on over 75,000 inpatient visits. It's a AHRQ data. And what this shows is that if this is the median, in the last decade, 2.2 times likely to have had prior irradiation. And oh, by the way, nobody's doing partial laryngeal surgery, or at least not like they were a decade ago. And these data are the same thing. High-volume hospitals are more likely to be doing it. The likelihood is you aren't doing partial laryngeal surgery, and then wound dehiscence and fistula is up. Probably not terribly surprising. And I think these data, again, this is from 78,000 patients, demonstrate the situation. So a couple of years ago in his trilogic thesis, Harry Hoffman pointed out that of the 24 cancers that are monitored by the SEER database, the only cancer group to experience a decline in cure is those with laryngeal cancer. So what's wrong? How does that happen? Well, ladies and gentlemen, our therapies are not very effective. We're uncertain about which therapy is best, and the toxicities of our treatment are not always acceptable. Pretty straightforward. The best data, the level one evidence, is all about irradiation and chemotherapy. There is no level one evidence in surgery. What are we going to do about it? Well, you know, we need articulate leadership. We need level one evidence. I heard yesterday morning Randy Weber made a marvelous presentation about a plan to formally develop clinical investigators. I think it's great. I think the major medical centers should do that, but I think it's too late. If we wait until Randy Weber makes clinical investigators for us, we will not know how to do the procedures that need to be done to save people from chemoradiation. We have to collaborate today. We have to talk about it, figure it out, and do it.